Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 22nd, 2018. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, from City Hall and the State House all the way out to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, we could use a great start to this week because it's a little gloomy out there, Dave. It's
rainy, foggy, almost October-like.
Well, I was out on the Storm Center patio, and I noticed that all of a sudden the street lights came on Upper Columbus.
As those lower clouds moved in.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That'll happen when they get low and dark like that.
So, July 22nd, and it looks like October 22nd.
October, but, maybe. But let's not get into October and November.
No, let's rush things.
July.
And, I mean, it's still very temperate out, despite the rain.
Oh, right. Yeah, we have 69 at O'Hare and 70 here along the lakefront. Highs of being around 80, temperature-wise, very comfortable for today and tomorrow. So that's good.
Yeah.
Rain moving out later this morning. Hopefully things calming down.
And it looks like low 80s for the rest of the week.
Yeah, pretty much into that. So we've got a nice stretch of weather ahead.
Yeah, that'll be good. That'll be good.
Although, always good.
Although not exactly your ideal grilling weather right now. You know, it's I was at a party for the birthday of the show's unofficial music director, my eldest daughter Amanda, and they have a place right at Wolf Point where the river triangulates, and reserved the outdoor kind of dock area, and everything was going great till then the rain started coming in a little bit, and everybody was rushing inside, and they were able to get back outside later, but it's just the traffic on the river these days is just amazing.
Well, I think part of that has to do, well, two things, of course, obviously, summer, but also the Riverwalk.
Yes.
And with that, in pedestrian traffic as well, walking, from various places from place to place, checking out the boaters.
Well, you got those organized, kayakers. the architectural tours and those boats were filled, just completely filled up and down the river.
Oh,
all
yeah.
Day.
Yeah. Summertime and the weekends, they're going to be.
Yeah, yeah. It's and the architectural tour is a great tour. I always, people that I meet that have never been in town, and it's like, what should we do? And I said, that's
take
number
that
one. That is the number one thing to
yep,
do.
One of the most popular tours in the city.
Well, I know you were out on the lake yesterday.
I was. And
the river looked choppy, so I can only imagine what it was like out on the lake.
This is why we have the breakwaters along the shoreline, the cement blocking areas, the blockades along Monroe Harbor and then up north toward Navy Pier, because that's exactly what they do. They break the action of the water. They break the waves, so things are much calmer as you get closer to shore. Once you get past those breakwaters, we were hitting 6 to 8 foot waves yesterday.
Wow.
And literally being tossed around. One of the photographers aboard the press boat was and had quite a good lens on his camera there. We hit a wave, and it knocked him over. It knocked him back.
Oh, man.
No one got hurt, but it knocked him back. And and also, I must tell you, unavoidable queasiness and seasickness.
Sure. How can you not
avoid those types of waves out there?
How can you not avoid it?
Yeah.
And I mean, credit to everybody that does the Mac. I mean, that's just,
especially in the weather like this, in these waters.
I mean,
that's dedication and bravery.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the a lot of Cardinal fans in town this weekend with the Cubs Cardinals series, and
they had a good time on Thursday, didn't they?
I don't want to talk about
Thursday. You don't want to talk about Thursday.
Thursday didn't happen, right?
Does anybody want to talk about Thursday?
Matt Carpenter, he's about the only one that wants to talk about this series.
What is it with Matt Carpenter?
You know, he struggled right out of the gate early in the year.
Yeah, I was looking at like the up to May 31st stats versus since May 31st.
He was hitting under 200.
Yeah.
And I think he's found the stroke a little bit.
He certainly has here with the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And you know, I don't know what in the second game of the doubleheader.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they just walk him? He didn't even start the second game.
Yeah, I know. It's Joe Maddon wasn't around.
I know that, and I I can understand that, but still, that should just be automatic.
True. You would think.
You're up 3-1. I mean, just put him on.
Yeah, I mean,
don't serve up the gopher ball.
I guess the law of averages would figure that he's not going to hit another home run.
Whose averages? Take a look at what this guy. What?
I know.
Six straight games?
Six straight games.
And of course, what he was 5-for-5 on that
day.
Miserable day. Yeah. Three home runs and two doubles.
Two doubles.
Seven RBI.
Yeah, he tied Chris Bryant. Chris Bryant was the first to ever do the three-homer, two-double game. That was in 2016 in Cincinnati. And now Matt Carpenter joins that crew. It's a crew of two.
Yeah, against the Cubs. Well, hopefully we can take the decider in the series, right?
Yeah, that's this afternoon. Of course, hopefully these skies will clear up a little bit. And Jose Quintana will go against the Cardinals' lone all-star, pitching all-star, Miles Michaelis, will go today.
So that ought to be good.
Yeah, should be. I mean, Quintana's had a little bit of an up and down, but I usually feel pretty confident when he's on the mound.
Yeah. And, I mean, we got to win this one. I mean, come on. We got to win this one. It's pathetic. Sox with a nice victory last night.
Yeah, how about Dylan Covey? He started the year really, really hot and then went through a streak going toward the All-Star break where he couldn't get anybody out and was coming out in the third and the fourth innings. And last night he goes a career-high 8 1/3. He had a no-hitter going into the sixth inning and only gave up two hits and no runs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's good to see, especially as the visiting team.
Yeah. And Avi Garcia hit a big three-run homer, too, coming off the DL. So I think some talk is going to start heating up around the White Sox and even the Cubs as well. The trade deadline is now 9 days away. And I'm sure there's going to be some interest in some of the White Sox veteran pitching.
Yep.
James Shields is notably among them, and a couple of the bullpen guys probably as well. Jose Abreu's name has been mentioned a couple of times. Avi Garcia might get mentioned. They're still a young player, but a tough decision kind of a thing for the White Sox because he's so young, but he's been rather inconsistent and hurt this year.
Who made that catch at the wall?
Oh, that was Leury Garcia at the wall last night in the ninth inning.
To keep the shutout.
Keep the shutout going. He went over the wall and left.
That was just amazing. Yeah. Just amazing.
Pretty impressive.
Fantastic. Well, a lot of sports going on.
Yeah, there's that golf thing going on.
There's
too,
that golf thing with keeping an eye on Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of an interesting third round that he had.
Yeah, 66, 5-under. It was pretty good. It got him into contention. And, you know, you never know with Tiger when he smells the kind of the blood in the water. That used to be the reason for wearing the finishing red on Sundays. I just saw a shot of him coming to the course at Carnoustie. He tees off at about 8:25 Chicago time. He's got a little bit of the red going. And you know, Jordan Spieth really played well yesterday. He's really going to become the first back-to-back champion in a decade. So it's going to be interesting to see how the course plays today. It's sunny out there, but it looks a little windy.
Well, and from what little bit I saw yesterday, Tiger was just putting lights out.
Yeah, he's got that new mallet putter that he went to a couple of tournaments ago. Says he feels a lot more comfortable with that for some reason, being able to firmly strike the ball there on the putting surface. And that's always been the key to his game. I mean, the key to his game when he was going really well was, of course, he makes some spectacular and unbelievable shots because he can hit the ball a long way, but it was always about the putting.
Right, right. Well, that's how you score. Mm-hmm. That's how you score.
Drive for show, putt for dough.
Indeed, indeed.
I can't do either.
It's all right.
Well, I, by the way, I have some bad news to report about our former domicile on Michigan Avenue.
Uh-oh.
The Tree of Knowledge has been removed.
What?
Yes. Yes.
When?
Apparently last week. Yes, the Tree of Knowledge out in front of Tribune Tower is no longer. But no sign of whether that means that Johnny Sixnote is still there.
That was my first first question as to where your favorite musician was hanging out.
I have to tell you, the other weekend, I had stopped down at that underground place that I venture to that has sports on TV sometimes.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, the Billy Goat. And okay. So, but it was raining, and actually, Johnny Sixnote was outside the Billy Goat playing.
Uh-oh. Right outside the door?
Pretty much.
You.
Yeah,
oh,
it was like, wonderful. Yeah, I mean, it's like, what the heck? Come on.
He's your own personal musician.
He's not a musician. He's not. Let's get that straight.
Okay, he follows you playing his six notes.
Various six notes, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, but the Tree of Knowledge is no longer. So I think the break is complete. With Tribune Tower, well, and me and all of that.
They don't want him on the Michigan Avenue Bridge anymore, which is why he ended up over at the Tree of Knowledge. Now he's down at the Goat. I think Sam may have a little talk with him at some point.
Yeah, you don't want to get on Sam's bad side either. No, you don't.
No,
absolutely not. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Cassera's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is trying to balance the buttons here in the brand new studios. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio on Upper Wacker Drive overlooking the Chicago River and kind of an angry Lake Michigan out there. Hope everybody stays safe at the MAC. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Tim Kaveny. He's the president and CEO of South Shore Hospital. It's a safety net hospital that's badly in need of funds to remain open, and we'll get the latest on his quest. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll speak to my good friend David Yepsen. David is host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press. He's also the former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. We'll talk to him about the president's strange week last week. And then at 8:30, we'll speak to Greg Bays. Greg is the retiring CEO and president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. He's also been a major part of Republican politics in Illinois for decades. And we'll talk to him about what changes he's seen over time in politics, as well as the outlook for manufacturing. That's coming up, but we're going to launch our weekly spin through national politics, and what a crazy week it's been, largely stemming from the president's summit in Helsinki, Finland, with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Some people are already calling it the surrender summit. Trump's been steadily trying to clean up the mess, but he's also been compounding it, including inviting Putin to come to the United States in the fall. Kind of a breathtaking show by the president of the United States, really kind of siding with Putin over his own intelligence services over whether Russia had interfered in the 2016 election. The belief is that the president feels that anything that might show Russian interference would in some way diminish his victory, and that's something he doesn't want to do. So let's start with the president in Helsinki.
I think we're all to blame. I think that the United States now has stepped forward along with Russia, and we're getting together, and we have a chance to do some great things, whether it's nuclear proliferation in terms of stopping, because we have to do it. Ultimately, that's probably the most important thing that we can be working on. But I do feel that we have both made some mistakes. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it. People are being brought out to the fore. So far that I know, virtually none of it related to the campaign. And they're going to have to try really hard to find somebody that did relate to the campaign. That was a clean campaign. I beat Hillary Clinton easily. And frankly, we beat her. And I'm not even saying from the standpoint, we won that race. And it's a shame that there can even be a little bit of a cloud over it. People know that. People understand it. But the main thing, and we discussed this also, is zero collusion. And it has had a negative impact upon the relationship of the two largest nuclear powers in the world.
So the investigation is damaging the U.S. relationship with Russia, according to the president. So, in Helsinki, a reporter asked the president, who do you believe? Who do you believe here? Effectively, he sides with Putin.
I think we're all to blame. I think that the United States now has stepped forward along with Russia, and we're getting together, and we have a chance to do some great.
Sorry, that was a repeat of the previous cut. We'll try again. And with a reporter asking, you know, you've got the whole world watching here. Why don't you call out Putin?
Would you now, with the whole world watching, tell President Putin, would you denounce what happened in 2016, and would you warn him to never do it again?
So let me just say that we have two thoughts. You have groups that are wondering why the FBI never took the server. Why haven't they taken the server? Why was the FBI told to leave the office of the Democratic National Committee? I've been wondering that. I've been asking that for months and months, and I've been tweeting it out and calling it out on social media. Where is the server? I want to know, where is the server, and what is the server saying? With that being said, all I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me, and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be, but I really do want to see the server. But I have confidence in both parties.
So then, upon return to the United States, the would-be becomes wouldn't-be. So effectively, he thought that would clean everything up. Obviously, it hasn't. And we continue in kind of this state of strangeness when it comes to the U.S. relationship with Russia. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Continuing our spin through national politics, the president comes back from Helsinki, facing criticism from all sides. The president tried to do a cleanup in aisle three of the West Wing.
I have full faith and support for America's great intelligence agencies, always had. And I have felt very strongly that while Russia's actions had no impact at all on the outcome of the election, let me be totally clear in saying that, and I've said this many times, I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also. There's a lot of people out there. There was no collusion at all. And people have seen that, and they've seen that strongly. The House has already come out very strongly on that. A lot of people have come out strongly on that.
But then, as the press was being ushered out of a cabinet meeting, Trump was asked, is Russia still targeting the United States? The president's answer, no.
Is Russia still targeting the U.S.?
Thank you very much, everybody.
Make a way out.
We're doing very well. We are doing very well, and we're doing very well, probably as well as anybody has ever done with Russia.
And there's been no president ever as tough as I have been on Russia. All you have to do is look at the numbers, look at what we've done, look at sanctions, look at ambassadors not there, look, unfortunately, at what happened in Syria recently. And I think President Putin knows that better than anybody, certainly a lot better than the media.
And that is the President of the United States. We're going to switch gears now, and joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Tim Caveney. He's president and CEO of South Shore Hospital. And, Tim, thank you for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Nice to be here.
I wish it was under better circumstances. The Medicaid shortfall issues, State of Illinois owes South Shore $3 million.
That's correct.
And
along with other vendors, there are a total of about $6 million that are owed to South Shore Hospital, and we have most of our vendors pushed out 90 to 120 days. They've been very understanding. We spend time on the phone with them constantly trying to help make it through the process. Barely enough money to meet payroll, but we're getting there.
But how much longer can this go on?
Not much longer, but that's why we're very optimistic with a $3 million grant that was appropriated in the budget for 2019. Beginning July 1st, 2018. So we're in the process of trying to get some of that money.
But that would be money that you normally wouldn't get.
That's correct. That's what I would call supplemental funding, beyond the reimbursement for public aid patients.
What is really the problem here? I mean, obviously we've talked a lot on this show about backlog of state payments for services and providers, but we were moving forward on that.
We've made some real good progress with the managed care organizations. You realize in 2014, the state moved all the public aid patients from fee-for-service over to the MCOs. And that created real havoc for all the safety nets because prior to that, we were called expedited. We filed the claim, and the claim was processed.
So that was moved, right, it was moved advance in the queue.
Yes, exactly. And then that was taken away when they moved all the patients over to MCOs, and now the MCOs are more like 90 days out from the date it's billing. So it created a real cash flow problem for us as well as the other safety nets.
I know, I mean, there was also the issue, too, about the fact of the Medicaid reimbursement and the federal match issue, which, I mean, safety nets have gone through an awful, awful lot. And the hospital assessment program actually getting renewed, that was supposed to fix some things, too.
Well, it will fix some things. They are going to see an increase in the public aid rates, which historically have been well below cost. And that's why we're looking for these supplemental reimbursement vehicles so that we can survive. If you can't meet your payroll, you can't keep operating as a hospital. And so the hospital assessment came in as a method to get us some supplemental funding. And now with that new program starting July 1st of 2018, we'll see a good increase in the inpatient and outpatient rates. However, we won't see that money until August or September.
And you're at the precipice.
Here we are. We are at a point where we can't last much longer without a cash infusion. And that's why we're really pressing the legislature. And by the way, I have to say that our Senator Sims and Marcus Evans have been, and the Black Caucus were extremely effective in getting this approved. We've tried to get this type of funding in the past and been unsuccessful. These guys really stepped forward and got it done.
But it's done in legislation. It's not turned around yet into the actual.
That's
cash.
Correct. We have to follow. We're being told we have to follow the grant process. So we're in the process of fulfilling those requirements in order to get the funds.
And you said there's other, but that's the $3 million grant.
Yes.
But there's also, you say there's still also another $3 million that's owed.
That's correct. Those are the normal receivables from the MCOs.
And is that in process through the state comptroller's office, or how
no,
does that
we,
money,
we
you
bill
get the money from the NCO?
We get the money from the NCOs, that's correct.
So that's nothing that can be expedited by the state?
No, that's correct.
That's just the bureaucracy.
That's right, yes.
What is the future for these vitally important safety net hospitals?
Well, that's a good question. Without funding, you can't continue to operate. So we're looking at changing what we do. We still need to provide inpatient services. We have a very busy emergency room. And those departments like the emergency room and the radiology and lab, all those departments need to be maintained for the community. They need to be something there for the people to have as a safety net. And that's why we're called a safety net hospital. We have a very, very high percentage of patients that are on public aid. And so we're very much affected by what happens in this program.
Is there a fear that we may end up with hospital deserts?
Yes, very much so. We have about 500 employees. About 70% of those employees live in the southeast side of Chicago. So if we were to close down, we're the major employer in that whole section of the city. It would be a desert, a healthcare desert, and a commercial desert, too.
I mean, we talk about food deserts and those kinds of things, but healthcare, I mean, there was just a story, I think, in the New York Times about rural healthcare, for example, and how, you know, a woman was giving birth, and she has to travel 4 hours to a hospital.
Makes it kind of impossible, doesn't it?
Well, is that a larger reflection on just the state of health care in this country today?
Not universally. There are certain areas that are deprived. For example, larger hospitals in the suburbs, for example, they have a large base of commercial business, and they can afford to absorb some of the losses from public aid. In our case, we don't have any commercial business. We're like over 60% Medicaid and then Medicare. And
when you say commercial business, are you talking about insured?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, insured other than Medicare or Medicaid.
Right, private insured patients. Yes,
that's correct.
So, there is very little leeway.
Very little. We have nothing to offset the losses from the Medicaid reimbursement.
You mentioned the local legislative delegation, but do you think the larger at whole body of the General Assembly understands the dire
situation? I really think they do, and this is a bipartisan effort. I think that's the reason why it succeeded. And there were three hospitals that were able to get some supplemental money, three that really needed the money.
But how do we stop? At what point do we stop going through these kind of crises? What is it? What
I think the best answer is to get reimbursement up to cover cost. And a little bit extra would help because you really need to be able to invest capital back into the business. And if you just cover your cost, you're not going to have the money to maintain your equipment, maintain your...
Well, covering costs that's only good at that time because costs will always increase.
Yep, that's correct.
I mean, how does somebody like you attract a workforce?
That makes it very difficult because of our location and because of the fact that we don't pay the high rates for salaries that are paid in the commercial hospitals. We just can't afford it. And so we try to get people when they first come out of school. And we work with them, we help train them, and a lot of times...
You're almost a teaching hospital.
Almost, yes.
I mean, without the technical term, but that's exactly what you're doing.
Most definitely.
So there is an attraction for those younger students.
Yes, and that works fairly well. You have to have really good process and really good procedures to follow, and you have to work together with them very closely.
I still have to wonder, though, I mean, you know, with Obamacare, we've seen expansion of Medicaid, which covers more people. But if the reimbursement doesn't get turned around, I mean, that's good that people have health care coverage, but what's it do for the providers?
It doesn't do a lot for us. We were rather happy that Obamacare was passed because we had a very high percentage of uninsured patients, and we thought that this would really help us and provide more reimbursement for us. And there is additional reimbursement because they're now covered under public aid. But then Medicare started taking back some of their supplemental funding to us because of Obamacare. They said that, well, now you don't have all these patients without insurance, so you don't need all these disproportionate share funding that we've been giving you, and they've been taking that away a little bit at a time.
So it's a give and take. You get it on the one hand as a disproportionate share of money because of uninsured, and now it's like, okay, now they're insured, so now you're not disproportionate
That's
share
correct.
Anymore.
That's correct. And lately our uninsured percentages have been going up.
Because costs have gone up under...
And some of the people that were on public aid are not on public aid anymore. They dropped off the rolls.
And then they become uninsured.
Yes. It's a vicious cycle.
Tim Caveney, President and CEO of South Shore Hospital, is my guest. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in studio is Tim Caveney. He's president and CEO of South Shore Hospital. We're talking about why he doesn't just throw his hands up in the air sometimes when it comes to the issue of getting funding, adequate funding for South Shore Hospital and to keep it going. I mean, we had a story in the Tribune recently about the issues there, and basically $3 million by August 1st, or the hospital shuts down.
Yes, funding is a critical issue for us. We are pushing our vendors out, as I mentioned, 90 to 120 days, and we're at a point right now where we're holding off on issuing any payments to vendors because we have to meet payroll by August 1st. And so that's a real critical issue for us. We have to do that.
And we were speaking off air about this $3 million appropriation that was contained, the supplemental appropriation passed by the General Assembly, but that you didn't know it was a grant.
That's correct. We thought the funding would be available to us on July 1st of 2018, and then when we inquired about it, we found out that we had to go through the grant process, which we haven't done ever that I can recall. So it's a new learning curve for us.
Well, and I don't. People not necessarily familiar with the bureaucracy. You know, a grant sounds like, oh, okay, we grant you $3 million. No, you've got to write and basically justify.
We have to put together a budget and file the paperwork for a grant. Yes, it requires some effort.
So that, I mean, that requires finding somebody who knows how to write a grant application.
That's correct.
And those are easy to do.
Not necessarily, although we've been trying to apply pressure and try to get as much assistance as we can from the Department of Public Health, and they've said that they would help as much as they could. So it's getting through the process that makes a difference.
So once again, it's more bureaucracy.
Yes, it is.
And that's a constant factor with what you do over at South Shore.
It is, and we try to take that into account. So we try to create a little bit of cushion for ourselves so that if things become difficult, we have a little bit of wiggle room, as put it.
But the wiggle room's running out.
It is.
I mean, we're literally days away.
We are about a week away.
And no assurances of anything.
The only assurance we have is that they'll work with us as best they can due to the process.
But that's...
And the process is what the process is.
Well,
yes.
But that's words. That's not, you know, that's not the money.
That's correct.
I mean, you touched on it a little bit. If you guys shut down, what does that mean for that neighborhood?
That means about 500 people would be out of work, that you'd have a healthcare desert on the southeast side of Chicago, and we're the major employer on the southeast side.
I mean, these are, and with decent salaries.
They are.
I mean,
we can't afford
the
salaries.
High, right. But these are, you know, decent professional salaries.
They are.
And you're the only provider of them.
In that area, that's correct. And so where will those patients go if they don't have South Shore Hospital to go to in the event that they have an emergency?
Where do they go?
They have to go over to the University of Chicago, which is over on Cottage Grove and 57th. And if they don't have transportation other than a bus, how do they get there? They can't go and call an Uber and have an Uber take them over there. I don't think that's going to happen.
And here we are.
Yes.
And here we are in this...
So we need help.
When the legislature passed this supplemental appropriation, I mean, you obviously had been talking to your legislative delegation for months.
We had been, yes.
So, I mean, this had been in process for months then.
Yes, we had tried through the assessment redesign to obtain the $3 million, but that didn't happen. So then we went back to the legislature and let them know what our situation was, and they were very, very, very supportive.
So during the process of when the reauthorization of the hospital assessment program came in, that you were trying to get included into that as the supplemental funding.
That's correct.
And that didn't
that
happen.
There was about additional $200 million plus of federal funding coming into that program, and we basically got nothing out of that. We are basically at the same level we were before that came in.
With the new program?
Yes.
So there's no real improvement in funding for...
Not in supplemental funding, that's correct.
But the assessment program is supposed to help safety net hospitals.
Yes, it is.
So I'm confused here.
So are we.
Well, help me, though. Help me understand. The whole purpose of the hospital assessment program is to help safety net hospitals. The program...
Well, that was why I'm scratching my head and wondering why it happened the way it is. It's all based on the design of the program. And They were looking at data from 2015, and the data was obtained through the managed care organizations, which in our case was about 30% below what we actually saw from our records. So we're wondering why that data was used. I guess it was said that that was the best data they had available. So it is what it is. Everybody's data was from 2015, but it just didn't work out for us.
Were there some winners?
Oh, there certainly were. There were a number of hospital systems and hospitals that were big winners. We were not.
And what made them winners versus your hospital?
I think that's a good question. I think that's something you have to ask the people from the Illinois Hospital Association who designed the program.
So those were larger hospitals?
Yes, mostly larger hospitals and hospital systems.
And as you say, they have private insured patients.
The larger hospitals have some cushion, I would call it, because they have commercial business, which the reimbursement is very high compared to public aid rates.
So it skewed against some of the most in need hospitals?
The rates are skewed against the hospitals that don't have commercial business. So like we're 95% public aid and right. Medicare, and we have no commercial business to speak of.
But if the program is designed to help safety net hospitals, it doesn't.
It didn't help us in this case. There were some safety net hospitals, independent hospitals, that did get an increase in their supplemental funding. We did not.
What about as far as, like, rural hospitals?
Well, there's some rural hospitals that are as bad off as we are, too.
I was just going to say, I mean, this isn't just a city-only type issue.
That's correct.
And much like what South Shore Hospital means for that neighborhood, some of those rural hospitals are the same as far as an economic base, as far as a wage base, as far as an employment base.
Yes, it's very difficult in those communities, too. It's not just the hospitals and the employees of the hospitals. The communities themselves are in need of those services. I was in the process of talking to my legislature about changing the mission of South Shore Hospital to something where we wouldn't have to continually come back for supplemental funding. But the message I got back was, no, the community needs you as an acute care hospital. You need to stay in that status. So basically the message is we need to have the funding to make it happen.
Isn't there some way that you can kind of partner up with some of those rural hospitals and as some kind of association of itself?
From a supplemental funding standpoint, I think that might work.
I mean, it would just seem because, you're transcending some of the urban-rural politics by if you could come together and work together in that kind of a framework.
And that's what we thought the hospital assessment redesign program would do. Unfortunately, it didn't happen in every case.
So, as I said, now we wait.
Yes. And well, we think that we'll get some movement next week. We'll be keep pushing, and we'll get our grant filed probably Monday or Tuesday at the latest, and then go from there. It goes through a process of review, and they come back to us requesting changes, and we'll respond to those immediately.
Can this move fast enough?
I hope so. It has to.
It has to. Tim Caveney, President and CEO of South Shore Hospital, thank you very much for coming on the program today, and good luck with everything at South Shore Hospital.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Been kind of talking about the president's performance in Helsinki and some of the fallout. And yes, there were supporters of the president's performance there. California Republican Congressman Daryl Issa defending Trump's assessment of U.S. intelligence.
We saw an example of the FBI not being trustworthy. We saw the downgrading of Hillary Clinton's criminal activity, the words being changed on Peter Strzok's own computer. So for the president to cast doubt is not unreasonable. At the same time, we take those charges seriously. And so I personally would neither rule in nor rule out the validity of a very interesting and odd-timed indictment of people who can never be brought to justice, and for whom there's even a question of how do we know? Did we use spy technique in order to find out? Did we hack them in order to find out who they were? So
And that's the reference to the indictments handed down against 12 Russians over their involvement into hacking the DNC. Now, there you have a Republican supporter of the president. There were also plenty of critics of Trump's Helsinki press conference, including retiring U.S. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. Here's what he had to say on the Senate floor.
Well, we saw earlier this week in Helsinki what was truly an Orwellian moment. What we saw earlier this week in Helsinki is what happens when you wage war on objective reality for nearly two solid years, calling real things fake and fake things real, as if conditioning others to embrace the same confusion. Ultimately, you're rendered unable to tell the difference between the two, and are at critical times seemingly rendered incapable of thinking clearly, your mind a hash of conspiracy theory and fragments of old talking points, deployed in response to a question no one even asked. Ultimately, you fail to summon reality in the face of a despot in defense of your country.
And that's Arizona retiring Republican Senator Jeff Flake. Joining me now on the phone is a good friend of the program and a good friend of mine, David Yepsen. He's host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press. He's the former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University and also a former national political writer and columnist for the Des Moines Register. David, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's good to be with you, Rick.
This has been... I suppose you could almost say this every week when it comes to speaking about Donald Trump. But truly, this has been one of the most remarkable weeks in an American presidency.
Oh, there's no question about it. If you look down through the list of stories and things that were going on in this past week, it's hard to remember a week that had this much happening every day. I mean, it just... things that would have been huge news in the past just were swamped by the news and what happened in Helsinki. So it's been a very incredible week. But the Trump presidency is that way, and who knows what next week will bring.
Well, you've got you kind of start the week with Helsinki, and then his attempts to kind of walk back from some of the things he said. Then you have the fact that the New York Times reports that his former personal lawyer Michael Cohen, in the FBI search of Michael Cohen's office, there are tapes of Michael Cohen and Donald Trump talking about hush payments to a former Playboy model that the president was alleged to have had an affair with. And I mean, it's just you get whipsawed by it all.
I think many voters at some point they start to tune it out. You've got a situation right now with a president that's very popular with about 30% of the electorate. It's hardcore. It's a base of people that just aren't leaving him. And then you've got a plurality of Americans who disapprove of the job he does. There's a new ABC Washington Post poll out this morning conducted after Helsinki. Most Americans did not approve of the way that it was handled. But there is a rock-solid base of Trump supporters. And, the question going forward in terms of the coming election is, what does this do? Do Trump supporters desert him over these mistakes? Do they rally around him? What happens to moderate Republicans? Are they with him? Are they against him? I think one thing for sure that's happened is the Democratic base, and particularly younger voters, millennial voters, are really energized, and I can see it in crowd sizes and things like that. And so if the energy on the Democratic Party and on the left, the anger, if the Democrats can find a way to bottle and can that, to get it registered into the polls, then they're going to have a very, very successful midterm election.
Well, you touched on like millennial voters, and you know, we always are told every election that you know the youth vote's going to matter, that the youth vote's going to turn out, and it never really does.
No, that's right. Younger voters just don't, and this has been true for decades.
Right.
Younger people just don't turn out. I mean, even the height of the Vietnam War, you had many younger voters that just don't pay attention. They're into other things in their lives. That once they start getting jobs and paying taxes and having kids and paying a mortgage, they start to get engaged, and that's a trajectory that goes on to when you're a senior citizen and you're very aware of the role government plays in your life, and then you're a good voter. But so I don't want to be sounding like I'm bad mouthing or millennial voters.
No, not at all. But you know, there is a certain element of there that is active among those younger voters, and you know, I just don't know if it results in a greater turnout. That's all.
Well, what I'm seeing, Rick, is if you look at these rallies and events that are being done by progressive groups, there is now an element of make sure you register and vote. You know, it's great to have a protest and show up for the TV cameras and great to have demonstrations, but unless it shows up on Election Day, you know, it really doesn't matter. But I'm starting to see registration efforts, registration tables. There's an understanding on the left that particularly in battleground states and in key congressional districts, they've got to get some of this energy harnessed and to the polls on Election Day.
We're speaking with David Yepsen. He's the host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press and a very good friend of your Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And I'm joined on the phone by my good friend David Yepsen, the host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press. And David, we've got a call. I think you could probably answer very definitely. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick. David, I wanted to ask you about the tariffs. A lot of the farmers are, you know, some supporters of President Trump, but their products are going to be affected with these tariffs. It's going to really affect them economically. So could you probably just talk on that a little bit, and more even in general, just how the overall economy is going to be affected, how that might, you know, have some repercussions for the elections. Thanks, guys.
Ron, that's a very good question, particularly in a state like Iowa or in Illinois downstate. Soybean prices are below the cost of production. Pork prices and corn prices are dipping. As the president threatens tariffs and starts to impose tariffs, other countries impose them back, and all of a sudden you're not selling anything, and you have huge surpluses that pile up, and prices go down. Now, the question that I think you're getting at, Ron, is what's the fallout going to be come November? And I think that's yet to be determined. I mean, it is true that the farm vote, the rural vote went for Trump. And I don't see at this point a big erosion there. I do see it starting to Trump's base in rural America. I do see it starting to crack. I see people having questions about how this is going to affect them. And Ron, you know, I think that's a great question going into the midterm elections, because if Trump supporters don't show up, Republicans are going to have at the polls, the Republicans are going to have a very difficult time in rural America because Democrats are energized. I don't see Trump voters becoming Democratic voters, but I do see some of them just staying home and being upset. But it's a long way yet until Election Day, and we'll see what farm prices are doing. And right now, the psychology in rural America is not good. If they're numerically, there are not as many farmers as there used to be, but they do set a psychological tone for everybody else in states like mine here in Iowa or downstate Illinois. The farmers aren't making it. A lot of other businesses don't make it. And so this is having an adverse effect on Republican chances there. And Republicans are very nervous about that. We'll see how it plays out come November.
Well, and certainly economics, pocketbook. Is a big motivator in elections, and it's been kind of interesting to see how Republicans thought with the tax cut passage, people seeing a little bit more in their paychecks, that could be a selling point for maintaining Republican control in Congress. But then if the tariffs continue and prices rise, you basically are eroding any of those gains from the tax cut.
That's right, Rick. And it's important to Ron's question and your point. You got to look at the economics. You got to look at the pocketbook issues, the numbers. Unemployment rates are very low. Stock market's sort of holding up there pretty good. Some people are doing all right. A lot of people are not. But it isn't a question of what the economics are. It's a question of how people feel. Are they feeling upbeat? Are they confident? And right now, a lot of Americans are not. Midterm elections are always tough for a party in power that holds the White House. And I think this is probably going to be true big time come November with Republicans and Trump people being a little down, Democrats and progressives energized. They're getting out and registering to vote. You'll see Democrats pick up the U.S. House. I don't think the Democrats can take the U.S. Senate. But you'll see governorships, like in Illinois and here in Iowa, in Iowa, the governor's race, a Republican incumbent, it's rated as a toss-up.
Which I was kind
Charlie
of
Cook, our good friend.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when I saw that. I hadn't been keeping up with what was going on in the race over there, but I just
right. And it's an incumbent Republican governor, and she running for her full term, and she's in a pretty close race. So this is all part and parcel of what I'm talking about, the midterm elections. This could be tough for Republicans up and down the ballot.
David is in my Sunday print story in the Chicago Tribune, where I took a look at the idea of, more than a week ago now, when Governor Bruce Rauner kind of went all in with the Trump White House after having spent so much time of his first term distancing himself from it, appearing in Rosemont with Vice President Pence. And then that's followed by Helsinki. And so, it's always one of those things about, you have to be careful who you hitch your star to.
Yeah, because that star can go up or it can go down. And in Governor Rauner's case, the time I spent, 7 years I spent in Illinois watching politics, it seems like he sometimes has difficulty finding a lane to run in. Is he a moderate Republican? How does he reach out to conservatives? There's a reason why now these rating agencies are saying Rauner is likely to lose to Pritzker. So you're closer to it than I am, but I just think it's a tough year for Bruce Rauner.
Well, and let's not forget that there's a third party candidate too with Sam McCann. Now, I don't know that he's going to get a whole lot of money, but certainly with those rural Trump voters that we're talking about, he's a factor.
And urban conservatives. I mean, look at what Jeannie Ives got in the primary against Bruce Rauner. Those conservatives are not happy with him. And if they don't stay home, they've sure got a place to vote now for Sam McCann.
That's David Yepsen, my good friend, host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press. He's the former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. David, as always, thank you so much for your insight. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. You know, if you want to get a sense of the state of politics in a certain state, it's true here, but just watch their ads for governor. In Georgia, here's an ad from the Trump-endorsed candidate, Republican candidate Brian Kemp.
I'm Brian Kemp. I believe in God, family, and country, in that order. I say Merry Christmas and God bless you. I strongly support President Trump, our troops, and ironclad borders, and I stand for our national anthem. If any of this offends you, then I'm not your guy. But if you're ready for a politically incorrect conservative who will end corrupt pay-to-play politics, I'm Brian Kemp, and I'm asking for your vote.
Now, here in contrast is an ad from the Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia, candidate Stacey Abrams. It focuses on diversity and health care.
Stacey Abrams, the proven leader that delivers for Georgia.
I have a boundless belief in Georgia's future, where more have the opportunity to thrive.
A fighter for expanding Medicaid. She put a stop to unfair tax hikes on working families, got Georgia moving on mass transit. As governor, Abrams will promote opportunities for families to thrive and raise bold and ambitious children. Stacey Abrams, for governor, a leader who will lift up all of Georgia.
I like the different contrast in the music as well in these ads. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Greg Bays. He is the outgoing president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Greg, thanks so much for coming into studio this morning and
thank you.
Fighting the marathon, as it were. You know, this is it's been quite a career. 4 decades in politics. 20-some years as CEO and president of the Manufacturers Association. And you were an early part of the Thompson administration. And I'm almost wondering, could a Jim Thompson get elected these days?
Be tough in the Republican primary because Governor Thompson was pro-choice. He was moderate in his views, really sort of the last vestige of the Rockefeller Republicans of the time. And for those who remember that time, the split between conservatives and what direction the party was going. Ronald Reagan sort of established what direction we were going as a party. Jim Thompson was a person who looked and understood how to get elected in the state. He knew he had to attract Democrats. In fact, he had buttons printed up that said, "I'm a Democrat, but," meaning they were going to vote for him. He knew he had to reach out to organized labor and not kowtow to everything they wanted, but to look at their side of the view. Illinois is a...
Look at the reality.
The reality of that and understanding the... geopolitical forces in the northern Illinois area versus southern Illinois. Sort of chuckling about the southern accent you heard in those commercials. The governor was pretty good when he got down in the southern part of the state. He could become one of them.
And he couldn't do the hymns really well in Vienna.
No, he really didn't have a lot of, if he's listening more, no offense, governor, you didn't have a lot of rhythm either. So it was a different time, different era. We've seen a transformation. I am saddened by the fact that we cannot speak to sort of the vast middle that's out there. People who may be moderately Democrat, moderately liberal about social issues, to those who feel very strongly about things like gay rights or abortion and things of that nature. There's no understanding that it's okay to have those opinions, and I don't mind you having that particular opinion, but don't force it on me, and don't call me names over the fact that I may have a different viewpoint of view. And that's what bothers me about the state of our politics, not only in Illinois, but across the country as well.
Well, off air, we were talking about, for example, DuPage County and mm-hmm. how Republican, I mean, that, let's face it, the collar counties, were the firewall right. of Absolutely. The Democrats' vote out of Chicago. That firewall eroded a long time ago. And when you look at kind of the evolution of politics. I mean, DuPage County Democrats, I remember they could convene in a phone booth, mm-hmm. okay? Now you have very intensive races going on. You've got suburban areas represented by Democrats in the General Assembly. And I think you've also seen kind of a evolution in who is a suburbanite.
Right. Anymore. Well, and look at the suburbanite Roscom-Caston race that essentially is a totally suburban race that 20 years ago, a Caston-like candidate wouldn't even be considered serious. Today, it's a toss-up race, and people are looking at that. It's going to be a bellwether on whether or not the House goes Democrat or not. The changing demographic that has occurred, not only with ethnic groups that have moved to the suburbs, but the viewpoint of the suburbanite in their how they view things. I mean, ideas of crime, transportation, and other things that's the issues they want to be talking about. And very concerned about the rising property taxes that continue to go up and saying there's no solution to this. And they talk to friends in other states and people compare property tax bills. They say, how can that be? And nobody is speaking to that particular question. We talk about it every once in a while. The elections get into it. But nobody really wants to look at it. And when they do in Springfield, it's sort of the room gets very empty because people really don't want to take it on because it is a politically sensitive issue like the pension issue as well. Let's just keep ignoring these problems and maybe they'll go away. The problem is they won't go away.
No, they won't go away. And of course, you know, property taxes have been an issue for decades, although I think with more urgency now than in the past. And certainly part of that perhaps fueled by the inequities that we've seen in Cook County assessments and then just going to the question of fairness.
We have this system that we've developed in Illinois that basically is a hodgepodge of way that we make an evaluation of your home, where other states do it very simply and how they do that. And the classification system, not to get into the weeds on this issue, in Cook County is really the big problem that has to be dealt with first. When we've tried to do that, Governor Edgar was really the last governor who took a real serious look at this and trying to do it. Remember the property tax for income tax swap and when you could do that. But at the end of the day, people could not come together on how that would work. And there are powerful forces around that issue that are going to have viewpoints on it.
Well, and you obviously have issues of local control for, I mean, because when you look at education as being the driver for local property taxes and local control of school districts, the issue of if you're going to reduce property taxes, you got to make up the money somewhere.
Right.
And that's why, you know, when I hear things about, you know, freezing property taxes and then but maybe assigning pension debt to local school districts, well, where are they going to get the money from for that? Right. I mean, there's you can't just move things around. You've got to actually figure out an established plan. And there's no doubt you want property taxes to go down, then you've got to find an alternative funding source for schools.
I think our whole tax system needs a reevaluation of what we do in Illinois and look at some other places and how they're doing. We're not unique in our fund. Everybody gets their money from somewhere. State budgets are sort of equal to the size of politicians or the size of the state. But politicians have a difficult time of wanting to change what people are somewhat used to in a circumstance. And I just marvel at the idea that our leaders of the General Assembly go to Springfield year after year. This gubernatorial race that we're watching going on, that there's no one wanting to really say, if we don't solve the pension issue in the state of Illinois, we are going to be the Puerto Rico of the mainland. And someone is going to have to say, how are we going to, quote, bankrupt these systems to reconfigure them? And who's going to be hurt? Those pensioners are going to be hurt. The state's going to continue to have a very bad reputation and see the loss of jobs that you and I talk about all the time. The state's going to not have the opportunity to really realize its potential. What we have in this state is so much greater than many other states that are doing well, but we have got these blots upon our reputation that people will just say, take them off the list. We're not going to even consider growing or expanding there. And I know there's a lot of positives as we look out these windows and you see what's going on in the city of Chicago. But you don't have to travel very far from this location till you see the hollowing out of our economy, the problems that we have, crime and other places, the closing one day at a time, as I've described it in downstate Illinois, when you drive through small communities and see where the manufacturing facilities have left and really the dollar stores are about the only thing that you're seeing of economic activity. That's the problem that I don't hear our leaders talking about in this election. And I think it should be a demand of people say, what is really your answer here?
We're speaking with Greg Bays, the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Greg Bays. He is retiring as president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Let's talk about manufacturing. It's to say it's challenging times. It's almost an understatement.
Right. Well, what I make the point when I started in 1991, 1.1 million people in Illinois worked in manufacturing directly in a facility. Today, that number is 600,000. Now, is all of it because Illinois is bad business climate? No. It is a change in what's happening in manufacturing.
Technology, digitalization.
All of those kinds of things. But our surrounding states, that you know, the Midwest, industrial and things of that nature, are being very competitive in drawing new businesses. You see the signs. I mean, if you'd have told me in 1991 when I started this job, we'd see billboards in Indiana saying, move to Illinois, and are you Illinoised? We'd have laughed at the notion that they were drawing those kind of jobs away from us. Today it happens all the time. We read about it all the time for various reasons. Again, our leaders ignore the basic problems that are caused by them. Manufacturing also is tremendously challenged by the fact of finding the skilled workforce. President Trump talked about it last week. He's going to continue to talk about it this week as well. And that is really the major problem that manufacturers across the country are finding. They cannot find the skilled workforce that are necessary to run the kind of equipment and machines, be in the modern manufacturing facility. And that is a challenge to our educational system. We talk about it all the time. We have an education foundation is speaking to it. We look to the German apprentice model as an example of getting people in the, when the average age of an apprentice in the United States is 23, in Germany it's 16. They start that process earlier where people are focused on that particular aspect of it. It's not the only answer, but it is an answer to that particular problem. So manufacturing also in this time period have high confidence, as the Trump administration came in and still does to this day. Regulation's been reduced. The tax cut was certainly a positive for businesses. But there's a concern, the tariff issue that you mentioned in your earlier segment, grave concerns. And in a state like Illinois, not only on the agriculture sector, on soybeans and corn and what that might mean, I can remember the Carter grain embargo of the remember over the Olympics. Corn went to $1.21. Soybeans were down in $2 plus range. So it can have an impact as surpluses rise and the ability to sell to the worldwide market. So Illinois is at great risk with the discussion of these particular tariffs and to the manufacturing facility or facilities. Our ability to trade with our trading partners, not only around the world, but our two most key trading partners from the state is Mexico and Canada. Those two states are our largest. And so how the reaction between a new administration in Mexico, certainly President Trump and the leaders of Canada not getting along, raises great concern for us.
Well, and also manufacturing is different in that you're not necessarily manufacturing a complete product.
Correct.
And so when you start talking about tariffs and trading, because you're taking things through multiple levels that can only exacerbate issues involving trade as you move along the process.
One of my members, they produce a component part for the BMW trucks that are made in South Carolina. And the steel for that particular product starts out in Germany. It moves to Canada, where it's further refined. Then it moves to the state of Illinois, where the facility is, then sent on to South Carolina. So look at the interrelationships between moving that product through three different countries to get it to a foreign manufacturer operating in South Carolina. The complications are enormous.
And that's why that has to be, I mean, the unknown of tariffs and potential trade war. And then we have the president saying now it's on to $500 billion worth of China goods.
Right. Well, that you know, to get into a full-blown tit-for-tat war on what we're trading as a world will hurt us all. Now, as a negotiating strategy, what the president is talking about and trying to do, let's give him his opportunity to do that. But let's not put at risk this economy that is growing, this economy that has been better for the last year and a half under the optimism of a Trump presidency. All the problems that Trump has from personal level and things of that nature, you look at what he's doing from a standpoint of America and keeping America in a proper position, you have to applaud him for that. And I think that is the opportunity that he has to maneuver this and come out on the other side looking better and the economy staying strong. If he remains, I think, strong-willed about this and not yielding, we could have some problems. And states like Illinois will be the ones that feel it. Let me say one other thing about the manufacturing sector. People like myself sometimes say a lot of negatives about what's going on. The positives of this state, though, are enormous. The diversity of our economy helps us. We do have a good workforce that can be trained. We need help in supporting our educational system to train that workforce. We need some economic changes or some changes in how the regulations impact manufacturing in this state. We should not see this sector of our economy continue to decrease. We can grow it in this state if the leadership that, whether it's Republican or Democrat, take a broader look of what's impacting this particular sector and remembering that 2.5 jobs are created for every one of those jobs that's created in a manufacturing facility makes it a enormously important sector.
Well, especially as you referred to earlier about kind of not far from where we're sitting, this hollowing out of Illinois, where you're looking now at as government facilities being the largest employer, right, kind of thing, where it used to be a manufacturer was the, you know, that they represented the county.
It should not be lost on the people of this community in the Chicagoland area that the west and south sides that experience the most crime and violence and terrible things that go on each and every day were once the center of manufacturing in this particular city.
A symbol,
right.
That's Greg Bays. He's the retiring president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Greg, thanks so much for joining me.
Rick, thank you as always being on. And I got one shout out I got to do. A personal privilege?
Absolutely.
It's a birthday for my daughter today, so I wish her a happy birthday.
Well, and a happy birthday from all of us at the Sunday Spin.